Justice Marquez, who will take office in a couple of weeks, will be qualified to participate in these cases if she decides to participate. Justice Malarkey's term ends tonight at midnight. Justice Minner will be sworn in as Chief Justice tomorrow and will preside over the oral arguments thenceforth. So, obviously, Justice Marquez will have to decide whether there's a reason for non-participation in some cases, but we do audio tape the arguments so she can listen to them and could participate. So, the case this afternoon is Hennessy versus First Transit, Inc. Counsel ready?
Petitioner is ready, Your Honor.
Okay.
As I respond.
All right, your argument, and please introduce yourself and who you represent.
My name is Stephen Cook, and I represent the petitioner, Patricia Hennessy. Good afternoon, counsel. May it please the court. My intention is to summarize for you what I perceive to be the more important or disputed issues between the parties, and of course also to answer your questions. Depending on how much time is consumed by that process, the desire will be to try and reserve some time for rebuttal. Concisely stated, this case comes before you as follows. Patricia Hennessy was driving her car in Boulder near a major intersection referred to as the Diagonal Highway and 30th Street. At the intersection, she had the right of way. A bus heading in the opposite direction turned left in front of her, causing a collision. Ms. Hennessy sustained injuries. The driver of the bus was Eric Cotton. He had been hired by First Transit as a bus driver. First Transit is a corporation which is in the business of providing transportation services internationally. RTD had contracted with First Transit to operate certain bus routes for RTD. The lower courts held that certain provisions of this contract, exclusively and conclusively, granted immunity under the CGIA to Mr. Cotton and therefore to First Transit. It limited Ms. Hennessy's recovery for her injuries to the amount of $150,000, which is the statutory amount allowed as a partial waiver of the old pre-statutory prohibition of recovery against governmental entities. The issue before you is whether, under that contract and under applicable Colorado law relating to sovereign immunity and to RTD's obligation to bid out to private contractors a portion of the routes which it operates, whether governmental immunity under those circumstances is extended to the bus driver and then the bus driver's employer.
Scripp, you just added a little wrinkle there in your statement about RTD's statutory requirement, I think, at that time to use private employers. What difference, if any, does that make in your analysis of the problem?
Your Honor, certainly the key statute is 2410-103, but we respectfully submit that the statute with respect to RTD's obligation to bid out contracts to private companies is useful for the court to examine, and it's pertinent because in that statute, you will see, as soon as I find it, you will see that the legislature refers to what will occur in the relationships between RTD and the private contractors, and it sets forth a series of criteria that refer to the contractors as private businesses. And nowhere in that particular statute, and I'm sorry, I'm having trouble finding it, it's 32, it's 119.5, and I'm forgetting the middle section, I apologize. Nowhere in that statute does the legislature imply or suggest that these private entities become public entities or are entitled to protection of the CGIA. It's not controlling, but I think it's useful for the court to look at.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I guess I'd like you to say more about that. There's one thing you say, we should look at it, be aware of it, that's nice, but what, if any, implications does it have? What meaning does it have for this?
We're supposed to admit that if you look to the statute, bear with me for a moment, Your Honor, I apologize.
It's 32.9, 119.5,
yeah,
parens 2, parens A.
Yeah. you look to that statute that Justice Bender just cited, you will see that the provisions of the statute require RTD to provide a certain percentage, presently 58% of the routes, to out for bidding to private contractors. So I submit, Your Honor, that this would be significant because under these provisions, the legislature has stated that, for example, under subsection C, 2C of that statute, the district, that is RTD, shall promulgate reasonable standards with respect to experience, safety records, and financial responsibility by which private providers can be qualified to provide vehicular services. One is to give them guidelines on which they have to follow in order to be able to bid. And they're referred to as private providers, Your Honor, and it also says, it makes it clear that the purpose of the statute, which ultimately leads to these contracts, is that there will be provisions provided by RTD to the contractor, which the contractor then has to comply with, as opposed to RTD controlling the hiring, the firing, and so on. Now, the statute doesn't address that specific issue, but an implication of the way this is set up in 32.91195 is that the legislature expected, intended that these would be provisions that RTD was to devise, for example, reasonable standards. There's other provisions in it, reasonable standards for reliability and performance, all of which the Court of Appeals and the trial court then took as provisions out of this contract. And so, RTD maintains control of the driver. Respectfully submit that that's not true in the contract, and does not accurately state the contract. But I also respectfully submit that this statute does have some relevance to the ultimate question of what did the legislature intend in creating.
But is your point that the degree of control reflects a statutory requirement and therefore cannot reflect the degree of control relative to determined employee status? I mean, I'm just not quite getting what you think the implication is here.
And I'm probably not making it very clear, and I apologize. I did not, in my summary, I did not suggest that this is the controlling statute. I do suggest, and have argued in the brief, and do argue it today, that the provision in 32.91.9.5 is consistent with petitioner's interpretation of the contract between the parties, number one, and number two, of what the legislature intended when it adopted the definition in 2410.103.
But you're saying that they seem to have intended independent contractors?
Sure, yes, Your Honor. And they refer to them as private businesses throughout 32-9-119.5. There's no hint or implication, Your Honor, that under by requiring RTD to go out and deal with private contractors, it was somehow contemplating that these people would be then entitled to immunities under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act.
I think it sort of speaks either way, though, does it? Does it speak in any way to the fact that they did not intend?
Does not. Not directly. May I continue? I believe I was stating that there were three issues which I intended to address to the court today. The first one is, was Mr. Cotton an employee of RTD even under a common law analysis? The lower court held that at the time of the incident, Mr. Cotton was an employee of RTD under and using a common law analysis. Both lower courts relied exclusively on certain, but not all or contradictory, certain contract language between RTD and First Transit in determining that Mr. Cotton was a common law employee of RTD. We respectfully submit that scrutiny of the contract establishes that such a conclusion was not justified as a matter of law under summary judgment rule 56. And in fact, examination and scrutiny of the contract and other evidence, testimony of Mr. Cotton, which I will get to, establishes the contrary. That is, he was not a common law employee of RTD. The second issue I will address is if this court were to determine that the trial court and the Court of Appeals correctly determined that Mr. Cotton was a common law employee of RTD, the next question is, was he a public employee under the CGIA? He was not, for two reasons that I hopefully will be able to articulate here today. First, the statute requires that, the statute defines a public employee as I wanted to get it right. I have it written down in many places. The statute defines a public employee under CRS 2410-103 sub 4 sub A as follows. Quote, public employee means an officer, employee, servant, or authorized volunteer of the public entity, whether or not compensated, elected, or appointed, but does not include an independent contractor. The two reasons why the statute does not apply is Mr. Cotton was not elected to RTD, appointed to RTD, or compensated by RTD, but even if the court finds that he's still nonetheless a public employee, the statute goes on to create an exception. So first it defines public employee in the first clause that I've just read, which means an employee of the public entity. I'm not going to refer to the language of officer, servant, or authorized volunteer anymore if I can avoid it, because it doesn't apply to the facts of this case. The only contention is that Mr. Cotton was an employee of the RTD. If you were to find that he was public employee under that portion of the definition, the definition goes on to say, but does not include an independent contractor. It goes on also to exclude people doing community service under sentencing. There are other exclusions in the next provision of the statute relating primarily to health care providers and community officers. But the exclusion that applies here is a public employee is not a public employee if they are an independent contractor. That's the way the statute is framed. Finally, if you determine that Mr. Cotton was a common law employee of RTD, and if you determine that he is a public employee of RTD under the statute, submit to you that such immunity does not transfer to the employer RTD. Section 217 of the Restatement of Agency Second, which referred to by the Court of Appeals, holds that or states that a private employer of a public employee is not protected from liability by official immunity, which shields the individual employee. Immunity does not exist, or if immunity does exist for Mr. Cotton, it does not extend to First Transit. With respect to the issue of whether Mr. Cotton was a common law employee, the case law in Colorado talks about this determination being fact-specific in individual cases. It says that many factors may be relevant in such a determination. It says that the list of commonly cited factors may be misapplied when rigidly construed. And the Norton case, among others, say that the court should look to the facts bearing on the nature of the party's relationship in practice. That's a quote from the Norton case. This case was decided on Rule 56, a motion by defendant. Ms. Hennessy was entitled to all favorable inferences, and of course the defendant had the burden of proof to show as a matter of law that there was no genuine issue of fact as to whether Mr. Cotton was an employee of RTD. The Court of Appeals held that certain provisions in the contract were the exclusive and conclusive facts to determine that Mr. Cotton was an employee. It did not consider, and therefore excluded, contrary contract provisions, which are evidence of First Transit's control of Mr. Cotton. And it did not consider or reference, and therefore excluded, Mr. Cotton's deposition testimony about his relationship between RTD and First Transit. And it's been cited in the brief, but Mr. Cotton's deposition testimony was that he had no relationship with RTD. He even gets sarcastic in the deposition about saying, hey, you're, no offense, buddy, but you're barking up the wrong tree. I don't know nothing about RTD. Pardon my language. Mr. Cotton's deposition and other provisions are contrary to the findings of the trial court and the Court of Appeals. Respectfully submit that the Court of Appeals misinterpreted and mischaracterized some of the contract provisions upon which it did rely. The one that's created the most heat and generated the most discussion in the briefs and I think in the appellate in the Court of Appeals was the statement by the Court of Appeals characterized at page 986 of the opinion as follows, quote, RTD has the right to require First Transit to remove any bus driver whom RTD considers unsuitable, close quote. Now, it didn't cite the, quote, the exact contract provision. In their answer brief throughout, the respondent refers to the right to fire, RTD having the right to fire, having the right to discharge. It talks about language saying, and someone who's terminable at will is therefore an employee. Mr. Cotton, RTD had none of those rights with respect to Mr. Cotton. The contract says, with respect to that provision about what they could do in terms of Mr. Cotton if they didn't like his performance, the contract says, quote, promptly upon written demand of RTD's contracting official, the contractor, in this case First Transit, shall remove from activities associated with the contract any employee whom RTD is considered unsuitable for such work.
Counsel, may I interrupt you and take you a little bit out of your train of thought, but something I've been thinking about is to what extent do we even have to decide whether Mr. Cotton is an employee if he's not, in fact, legislatively defined as a public employee? Shouldn't that, I guess a different way to answer, ask that question is, shouldn't that be our first inquiry or should it not?
For this court, I would absolutely want, I personally, and I think my client would want that to be the first inquiry. And yes, if you decide he's not a public employee under the statute,
then we don't really care whether he's an employee or not. So if we skip forward to whether he's a public employee, I take it you just kind of agree with what the state said in their amicus? Would that be a fair assessment or not?
So
I take it you would just agree with what the state said in their amicus brief?
I agreed with what the state said in the amicus brief. I had some comments I wanted to make about that.
Please.
With respect to, and I think I'm making an argument or two that aren't necessarily articulated that way in the state's amicus brief, the language of the statute contains this provision, which is interesting. It says a public employee means an employee of the public entity. Interesting definition. And then it says, whether or not compensated, elected, or appointed. I see that, and I read that the person has to be compensated and elected or not appointed, or appointed and compensated and not elected, but he has to be, the employee has to be, somehow have a relationship of that nature with the public entity. Interestingly enough, the First Transit looks at that and says, well, it doesn't matter whether he's compensated, employed, or not, because it says whether or not he has that compensation, he has any of those relationships. And I submit to you that that's the incorrect analysis, and this court should determine that there has to be some relationship between the employee and RTD. Because otherwise, and here the only contention is he's an employee. It's undisputed he wasn't paid by RTD. He wasn't a volunteer for RTD and so on. And he wasn't appointed and he wasn't elected. So if you say under the whether or not language that he's got to, he doesn't have to have any connection to RTD that meets that definition, then I respectfully submit the whether or not language has no meaning. It's superfluous.
The next clause says, but
does not include an independent contractor.
That's the next, I argue that there's two provisions under which it's determined he's not a public employee. The first one is that he was not compensated, elected or appointed, are the three words. And if he's not, then he can't be a public employee. If you decide that, we think he can be, even if none of those things happen, then he becomes a public employee, but then he's excluded under the, but this does not apply to independent contractor language. Am I making sense, Judge, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Cook, if we accept that argument for a minute that the amicus makes and that you make, does that mean we have to overrule the whole idea of the Perkins and the case out of, I think, Beaver Creek or Vail, I forget which one, which basically talks about dual employees, public and private?
You don't have to overrule Perkins.
Why not?
Because in my respectful, my humble opinion, Perkins is not dispositive of the issues in this case. In Perkins, the independent contractor language wasn't even raised. In Perkins, it was decided on a motion to dismiss into 12b-5. It turned into a Rule 56 motion, but there was no discovery conducted, and apparently none requested. The statutory definition that is being addressed, discussing with Kevin, discussing with you now, isn't even referenced in Perkins. Perkins takes a common law analysis and applies to the facts of that case, and under Perkins, the court said, under a common law analysis, that particular driver was an employee of Laidlaw. Laidlaw was the private contractor in that case. So no, you do not have to overrule Perkins to accept the argument that is being made here by Ms. Hennessy and the state that the definition of the statute excludes Mr. Cotton from being an employee of RTD. If you disagree with my analysis on that, then I would argue, as I've said in the brief, that you should overrule Perkins. I don't think that's needed here. It just isn't dispositive. The issues in Perkins just aren't raised. The statute isn't raised, and it's limited to a common law analysis.
Well, do you think that under the statute you can be both a public employee and a private employee, a dual employee?
To the extent a private employee and is sometimes an independent contractor of another entity, the answer to that question is under the statute, conceivably, under the first phrase of the statute that says a public, that describes a public employee as an employee of the public entity, it's conceivable that there would be some circumstances where someone would be an employee of the public entity and an employee of the private contractor. I respectfully submit there's no facts in this case to support that conclusion. But conceptually, could that happen? I think it could. Once, you'd still have to apply the whether or not language and determine whether they were compensated, appointed, or elected before they become an employee. But if they met that provision, then you could say, okay, yep, they're a public employee. Now we go on to whether they're also an independent contractor, which by definition, as I understand it, Your Honor, would mean they are an employee of a private company, the independent contractor, and then you have to make the analysis that they are excluded from being a public employee because they are an independent contractor.
To what extent is that analysis circular? Yeah. I mean, isn't that kind of the problem here?
To what extent?
Where does one enter this circle?
Both sides are essentially accusing each other of being circular. They're saying, well, once you're an employee, we stop talking about whether you're an independent contractor because you can't be both. And so their argument is, well, he's an employee under the common law and under discussion. We don't even have to talk about the independent contractor. I respectfully submit that I don't think it's circular to say that if you determine they're a public employee under the definition of the statute, and I submit to get there, you have to also first determine they were an employee under the common law. But if you determine they were an employee under the statute, a public employee, then you have to determine whether they were an independent contractor and whether, therefore, they are excluded from the statute.
Well, isn't it helpful if we talk about these words in a really precise fashion? Employee, public employee, an independent contractor. So what do you think the difference is among those three categories? Because the statute seems to talk in terms of the public employee.
I think that's exactly the way you should do it, and I'm hopefully, I was obviously inarticulately trying to say that. From my analysis, the determination of whether he's an employee is the common law analysis. Respectfully submitted that the court made the wrong decision by a mile on that one. The next inquiry is, if they are an employee under the common law, are they a public employee under statute? Now, as you have pointed out, you could go right to that matter, and I think you should, and say, we don't care if he was a common law employee, because under the public employee definition, First Transit was an independent contractor. He's an employee of First Transit. He's an independent contractor. And I submit that would end the inquiry. You do not have to go through the common law analysis. And then the final analysis would be, was First Transit an independent contractor? Quite frankly, that hasn't even been litigated in this case. I mean, everybody has acknowledged that First Transit is an independent contractor. First Transit acknowledges it in their brief. They say, the petitioner is misstating our position. We never said that, they were an independent contractor. We just said that Mr. Cotton was an employee, and then we get that as under an analysis of respondeat superior. So there's not been any contention that First Transit was not an independent contractor. First Transit was an independent contractor. Respectfully, that's not disputed in the record. So going back to the issue, and I'm probably over-focusing on a small point, but this language of whether or not in the definition, I wanted to direct your attention to the language in the declaration, the legislative purpose provision of the CGIA, which is 2410.102. A middle sentence in that long paragraph in describing legislative purpose says, it is also recognized that public employees, comma, whether elected or appointed, comma, should be provided with protection from unlimited liability. Well, that's interesting, I found, because the word whether or not isn't contained in that provision. It says, here's our legislative purpose. Public employees, whether they're elected or appointed, should be provided with the protection. So I respectfully submit that in construing the definitional statute, 103 sub 4, that this declaration reflects that the intent of that language of whether or not appointed, elected, or compensated in that statute is reflected in the legislative purpose in 2410.102, which says it limits public employees to or describes them as whether elected or appointed. It can say whether or not elected or appointed. The words or not, respectfully submit, should be construed by this court to mean that the employee has to have some type of relationship with RTD by way of appointment, election, or compensation. So much for the best laid plans. I'll reserve my last 3 minutes, if I may.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. William Rogers on behalf of the respondents, First Transit, Inc., and Eric Victor Cotton, counsel. There are two issues which this court accepted certiorari to review and that I would like to address with you this afternoon. The first issue is what counsel spent his time discussing, which is essentially, can Mr. Cotton be considered a public employee for purposes of the Immunity Act, subject to the damages limitation contained in that act? The second issue was addressed in some detail in the reply brief, but not today, and that is, assuming that he was in fact a public employee, is that limitation on damages something that applies similarly to First Transit as Mr. Cotton's employer? I think since most of the time in argument this afternoon was addressing the first issue, I'll start there, but I most certainly want to deal with some of the issues in the reply that we haven't had a chance to address.
But before you get deep into that, could I just ask you to address the statement that opposing counsel made right at the end, that there's absolutely no contention here but that First Transit is related to RTD as a private contractor rather than an employee?
I think that just has to be correct. They are a contractor with RTD. Whether or not we're dealing with nuances of whether it is an independent contractor is not something, frankly, that's been raised at the trial court at the Court of Appeals or with you, or whether it would even be considered an instrumentality. That is not before this court and not an argument that the respondents are making.
It does seem to have a big effect, though, doesn't it, on the broader view of what the Court of Appeals rationale does? If First Transit is clearly an independent contractor, has this rationale that we have before us then basically written out the exception in governmental immunity for independent contractors, unless the independent contractor is a sole service provider, unless he's all by himself?
I don't think it has, and I think that question leads, frankly, into the second issue, and I think I'm just going to address it now, because the primary argument that's been raised by some of the amicus briefs and by plaintiffs throughout, Ms. Hennessy throughout, is that First Transit is trying to avail itself of immunity, and that by arguing that it can be liable to no greater degree than can Mr. Cotton, it is essentially trying to claim immunity status, or governmental immunity status, despite the fact that it is a contractor and a private enterprise. And that's just not the case. That's not the argument that's being advanced.
Mr. Roger, can you throw in the hopper here another piece? Maybe it's irrelevant, but the definition of public entity under the CGIA statute and how that fits your client?
I can, and let me pull it in on the backside, if I may. The,
sure.
The issue here as to that second issue that this court is considering is not a CGIA Immunity Act interpretation. It is a fundamental respondeat derivative concept. Of
I think most of us are pretty clear agreement on the vicarious liability and respondeat superior. We have to apply it in this case.
That actual rule of law is something that wasn't really challenged at all at the trial court or at the Court of Appeals. And that is the issue that was raised really in the reply brief on behalf of Ms. Hennessy, which is the restatement section 217 sub B sub 2, which states generally that if an employee has immunity, that doesn't necessarily mean that the employer does. And that's the issue that I'd like to focus in a little bit, because, well, first of all, this isn't an issue that was raised by Ms. Hennessy and preserved below. And the Court of Appeals noted that in footnote 2 in its decision. And, in fact, the petitioner's opening brief even states it is correct that Ms. Hennessy did not cite this provision for any of her contentions. It's not an issue that was preserved. Nevertheless, it receives a great deal of treatment in the reply brief. But I think more fundamentally, from an analysis standpoint, 217 is very clear on what it says and what it is. It is dealing with immunities. And the comments to Section 217, I think, are very instructive in analyzing that. The comments provide that immunity is a word which denotes the absence of civil liability for what would be a tortious act but for the relation between the parties or the status or position of the actor. And the comments give examples, the immunity that a parent has from a claim by a child, or that a spouse has from a claim by his or her other spouse, the husband has for a wife. There is no appellate case that we've been able to locate that extends 217 to a limitation on damages. It is strictly an immunity. And there is a distinction between those two comments that I think are concepts that I think the petitioner tries to blend together in her reply brief. 217B, a different restatement section, but obviously very close in the book, provides that judgments of varying amounts for compensatory damages are erroneous. And that is a section of the restatement that's cited in the Lathrop case, the California case that the Court of Appeals referenced and that shows up in our briefs. And the concept, I think, is best articulated this way. The Immunity Act itself provides for sovereign immunity or immunity for public entities. The Act then waives that immunity in certain discrete areas in Section 106 of the Act. Once that immunity has been waived, Mr. Cotton is urging and advancing only the limitation of damages, which appears in Section 114. That is a limitation or cap on damages. It is not an immunity, which, for an action such as this one anyway, has been waived. And a damages cap, I think, shows up in a variety of contexts under Colorado law, whether it be non-economic damages, wrongful death, a dram shop, health care. It shows up in a variety of places limiting the amount of recovery. It is not an immunity. It is simply a decision by the legislature as to what type of remedies are available. Here, this court has previously addressed the issue of the distinction between an immunity and a remedy. And in the Gladden case, which the Court of Appeals referenced in the same footnote, footnote 2, the court stated that after the waiver has taken place, either by operation of law or by the action of a party, there is no defense of immunity for the City of Colorado Springs in that case to assert. And the opposing party there tried to argue that the damages limitation was also a retained or reserved immunity. And this court said no. Rather, that section, 2410.114, simply imposes a limit on the recovery allowed, making the distinction between an immunity and damages. So I think getting
but,
that...
But the whole rationale was to save the fisc, though. I know you want to respond to that. Justice Coates there, but would you add that? I don't quite understand. I don't understand the disjoint there, because it's clear that with this limitation of damages, they want to save the public purse. Here we've got a private entity, a contractor.
But it's not, the goal is certainly to provide a limit on the public purse or its openness. But it's not an immunity in the same sense that the limit on recoverability of non-economic damages has its cap. It's a limitation on recoverability, but it is distinguishable and distinct from an immunity. And immunity here has been waived by operation of statute, 106A1, the operation of a motor vehicle. So immunity is off the table. And the only thing Mr. Cotton is claiming, if he establishes for you his public employee status, is that limitation on damages, which is why I think indirectly and hopefully in a responsive way, getting back to your question, is the definition, I think, of the public entity relevant, as well as your question. The definition of public entity, I don't believe, is relevant, because we're dealing strictly with the application of the derivative liability principle. First Transit is not availing itself of that statute. So I don't think it provides any insight into analyzing the respondeat superior issue or in determining whether Mr. Cotton is entitled to claim public employee status. At least I would respond in that fashion. And I don't know if in that long, drawn-out discussion of the restatement, if I actually got around to addressing your point, but I'm sure you'll tell me if you don't believe I have. But I do think, though, that the cases, the Gladden case in particular, I think, is very clear on distinguishing it. And if it indeed is not an immunity, and I don't believe that it is or can be considered as such, 217 is irrelevant, an application of derivative liability rules really elementally that First Transit can have no greater liability than its employee. And I think that determination, whether Mr. Cotton is entitled to claim that status, is seemingly what is of interest to the court today in any event. I think the fundamental place to start here is how you determine whether a worker is a public employee. And the definition, counsels are in support of this court, it is a relatively straightforward piece of legislation. It says what it says. But we have guidance from this court on how to interpret that language in the context of a public employee circumstance. In Norton v. Gilman, this court, at page 567, directed how to make that determination, and directed very specifically when analyzing this very same statutory provision, you utilize the common law test. And as the court stated then, in other words, public employee simply means employee. The issue was on the table, the statutory provision being analyzed when the Supreme Court issued that determinative guidance was 103.4A, which is the very statute here that Mr. Cotton relies upon. The most important factor under that test is the right of control, not the actual exercise of control. That right of control, as this court said, was the key consideration. So in the briefing and today at argument, generally, I think what the primary argument is in terms of making this determination is we have this independent contractor language. What do we do with that? And I think some of your questions address that very same issue. And I think what petitioner desires that language to say and desires this court to interpret it to say is that it shall not, or but does not include an independent contractor or employee of an independent contractor, because that's what would have to cover the circumstances that we're addressing today. And it doesn't include that language. And petitioner, I would submit asking this court to add that language into the definition, and that is not what Norton directs, and it is not a reasonable interpretation of that statute. It was, I think if you're going to ask why, is the language there? What is, there is a tautological sort of aspect to it. If someone under the common law is an employee, then by definition, they should not be considered an independent.
But then we have to look again at the reason for the damages cap. The articulated reason in our cases, as I understand it and recall it, is the fact that it's taxpayer dollars at issue. Okay? We don't have that here. I mean, I don't know how you disconnect the damages cap from the waiver of immunity. The legislature did that in the same time in tandem to address this court's holding that sovereign immunity was violative of, if I recall, due process.
Well, it did do them in the same statutory.
Well, why aren't the damages caps solely limited to the governmental entity context? And then, of course, the public employee needs to be protected so that he or she isn't opened up to individual personal damages.
I've addressed that to a certain extent to the degree that I believe an immunity is simply a different legal concept. But I think the issue here analytically is whether or not Mr. Cotton can reasonably be considered to have been a public employee under the definition that the legislature has provided. Because it does include those employees of public entities.
But don't we have to look at the scheme as a whole? And you made this argument about there are damages capped the legislature and inserted in legislation. They certainly could do that if they say that the public entity enters into a contract with a private entity to provide a public service. They could put the damages cap on there. They have not done that, have they? You're trying to argue through some kind of a public employee definition that's unhooked, it seems to me, from the act as a whole, to hold this company, only liable for the government's cap. I'm not getting through on the legislative scheme of how you get there. I hear you parsing the words.
Well, I hope it's not just parsing the words. I mean, I if you're looking at the intent of the definition here, which is, after all, what Mr. Cotton claims, he is, and it's really the sort of the next step in the process. If this is how you define a public employee, does Mr. Cotton fit under these circumstances? And that's driven by the RTD contract with First Transit. But stepping back a little bit, if you're trying to determine, I think what you're saying is it just or equitable for Mr. Cotton to...
No, I'm saying, did the General Assembly intend to limit the damages of a private entity? And a private person who works for that and gets paid by that private entity.
The argument that respondents are advancing is not directly that First Transit is entitled to a limitation under the Government Immunity Act. The argument instead is, under respondeat superior, it can't be more liable than its employee. And its employee is a co-employee of both RTD and First Transit and qualifies as a public employee. Now, the consequence of that may be something that one could deem undesirable, depending on one's perspective. But that, to me, I believe anyway, suggests that if it is in fact undesirable, that's something the General Assembly can address, and not necessarily in a judicial fashion by including something in a definition that doesn't exist. And I don't know if that's responsive or not.
No, I agree. The issue is, what did the General Assembly intend? So I think I understand your argument.
And may I chime in here? So the essence of your argument is that only the independent contractor itself is immune or is excluded from the definition of public employee, not the actual person who's doing the work.
I think when the General Assembly is...
But is do I understand that correctly?
I think you do, but I think it's a little bit more than that, in the sense that when you're determining whether or not an individual can qualify as a public employee, because that is what Mr. Cotton claims entitlement to, you need to apply the common law to make that determination, because that's what Norton tells us that we must do.
So which the problem here, you think, from your perspective with the statute, is that if the legislature had wanted to make this totally clear, they would have said, and no independent contractor or employee of an independent contractor.
I believe that's what the petitioner asserts, that this language, how this language should be read.
So First Transit here is not a public employee, but the person who works for First Transit, Mr. Cotton, is.
As a co-employee of both First
Transit. And that doesn't seem an odd result to you?
It's not so much an odd result. It's the sort of the natural application of derivative liability.
But the way that we would determine whether someone is an independent contractor or not would go back to the powers that First Transit has, not the employee. I mean, it's clear Mr. Cotton doesn't have any sort of common law powers of an employer or an employee, right? He just is the guy who drives the bus.
He is an employee.
Nothing but that. So if we're trying to figure out what really a public employee is, then we have to figure out what the rights and responsibilities are of First Transit.
I think the issue isn't so much whether Mr. Cotton is an employee of First Transit. It's been undisputed throughout this litigation.
He obviously is. Sure. So we know a few things that we can. We know he's an employee of First Transit. We know First Transit is an independent contractor. We know if somebody is an independent contractor, they're not a public employee. Those things we know for sure, right? Would you agree with all of those?
If an individual qualifies as an independent contractor, he. As the common law defines it, he could not be defined as a public employee. I would agree with that.
Well, not individual, or it doesn't really matter whether someone's an individual. We just know that this whole concept of independent contractor cannot be a public employee. Whatever an independent contractor is, that can't be a public employee. But your position is that an independent contractor, according to the statute, doesn't include the people who actually do the job.
There are a variety of workers who could perform services for public employees, and some of them would be determined to be independent contractors, some would determine to be employees, and I suppose some of the other categories in that definition.
Well, give me some examples, if you would, please.
There are volunteers who perform work for counties and communities in a variety of different contexts, and there are, if you hired me, I have my own, I'm an individual, and I provide sweeping services to keep the steps of the courthouse clean, but I also provide those services to a variety of other buildings, public and private. You tell me to go out and sweep the steps, you don't give me a broom, you don't give me much direction, you just tell me to get it done. Under those circumstances, in analyzing my role vis-a-vis the court, in terms of performing my duties under the common law, as Norton directs, I would probably be determined to have been an independent contractor.
Yeah, but if I hire a sweeping service for whom you work, you would not be.
In that case, I think the issue would be you still need to look at it under the common law to determine whether that individual was an employee.
Let's keep going on with these examples. What are we looking at?
Sweeping example?
Please.
I'm wishing I was with a broom right now. I think what is significant here is the definition doesn't, it's not a malleable one. It doesn't change given the circumstances. It is what it is. Under the common law, was the worker an employee? What's different, I think, about this circumstance and what generates the argument that the respondents have presented is the earlier Perkins decision, as well as the incredible language of the RTD statute, as well as the RTD contract, that so thoroughly tells me as a sweeper, you must go from right to left, you must start on the top step, you must use this type of broom, and you can do nothing else. It's because of those unusual circumstances that frankly, I think are not duplicated in any other type of public contract with which I have familiarity anyway.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Your opposing counsel suggested at the very beginning of his comments, though, that the RTD contract, which kept talking about these sweepers, if you will, as private, was something that we should take into account. And I take it favorably from his perspective that if you're a private person, according to the contract, you're not a public employee.
I think that the relevance of the RTD contract is not to provide or shed light on the determination of public employee status for Mr. Cotton. The relevance of the RTD contract and the statute that generally leads to the drafting of that contract is at the next step. Under that common law test, was Mr. Cotton an employee of RTD? Because the statute and the contract so thoroughly pervade his performance of his duties. And And the petitioner in her reply brief suggests otherwise, and the detail was not included in the answer brief because it frankly wasn't raised in the opening brief. But it was before the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals itself went on for 2 pages itemizing the incredible detail that RTD exercises over Mr. Cotton's performance of his duties. But I think the relevance of the RTD statute and the contract come at the next step. I mean, the first step is to determine how do we decide whether somebody is a public employee, and the next step is, okay, was this guy a public employee under these facts and under these circumstances? And under this contract, it's really, I think, relatively overwhelming in terms of the factors that demonstrate the right of control, which is, as this court has said, is the key consideration.
State hires people to do all sorts of things for it who aren't state employees, and it hires them through generally corporations or something similar to the people you represent. So this is a pretty broad-reaching opinion in lots of ways, because this definition, which we haven't really grappled with before.
I think the amicus state of Colorado and CERSA expressed that concern. And I think the answer to that really has to be going back to the question that you posed with my opponent, and that is, what do we make of the RTD statute? And I think that the amicus brief filed by RTD addresses that issue. This is a unique circumstance in the state of Colorado. By law, over 58% now of RTD operations need to be handled by private contractors. That is a determination under the RTD Act. And the statute itself, as well as the contracts that flow from that statute, are just so different, I think, than the other scenarios that this court could potentially imagine, that I don't believe that is a concern. It's not a broad opinion in that sense. It's very narrow, and what the respondents are requesting is the same narrow application that the Court of Appeals provided in its decision. It is unique to this creature of contracted RTD services because the definition doesn't change, but the application of that definition to this particular co-employee of a public and private entity does change, or is different than most scenarios.
If you're right on your interpretation, though, why in the contract does RTD have this provision for pretty comprehensive insurance policy?
Well, I think for a lot of reasons. For one thing, buses can have a lot of people on them, and insurance above and beyond the level provided in the damages caps, even non-Colorado governmental immunity damages caps, could very well be implicated in.
Well, there's a cap per incident, isn't there?
There is a cap per incident,
and it's fairly small. I mean, it's not a busload.
And I think perhaps, well, a bus has 20 people on it, and First Transit could have claims against it, of course, that are non-derivative. I mean, insurance covers a variety of things. First Transit could be sued for direct claims, for negligently maintaining the bus pursuant to RTD's standards, for negligently doing a variety of things that provide for direct negligence. The position advanced by the respondents in this case is far more limited. The respondents assert only that in this scenario, one of vicarious liability on a respondent superior claim only, should this argument apply. We've made no argument that it would apply in a direct negligence claim. So when you ask why insurance, well, there are a variety of circumstances that would exist here. And of course, the Perkins case has been around for, I think, 16 years leading up to today, and is in the background when these contracts are negotiated and everything else. I mean, both sides spend some time raising some policy issues in their briefs, and I don't believe this court needs to get to those, quite frankly, and I'm not going to bother to regurgitate them to you today. They're in the briefs, and we've had our say, and so have they. But I think fundamentally on the insurance, I don't think it's germane to your determination here as to how we decide who is a public employee and whether Mr. Cotton falls within that analytical determination. Because I would submit he does. And the reason that he does is because this circumstance is so unique and so different from a typical public-private arrangement. And the uniqueness arises in no small measure because of the RTD statute.
I'm sorry, I think I'm dominating your time. I don't mean to do that. But I'm just looking at this RTD amicus brief, and they seem to be saying something a little bit different than what I understand you to be saying right now. They say on page 13 that they agree with Colorado that employees of a private business contracting with any public entity, including RTD, should not generally be considered public employees. and therefore entitled to governmental immunity, and then they say, and that independent contractors are not entitled to governmental immunity, which the statute says. That seems to be different than what you're saying. What the whole thrust of the RTD brief seems to be just tell us how we're supposed to do business these days in light of this opinion, but not so much in terms of the legal principle that there is a difference between the private business and the employees of the private business. Could you help me understand that, please?
Well, I don't dare to speak for RTD since I've
I'm just quoting
for you, but, yeah. But as I listened and I've read the brief, obviously, sure. As I listened to the portion that you just quoted, I think it is frankly consistent with my position here.
You help
and
me,
that
please.
Is that this analysis of whether Mr. Cotton can be considered a public employee is driven by the uniqueness of the RTD circumstance. And I think what the reference there, as I read it anyway, meant was there are a variety of other contexts where a private entity will come and provide services for a public entity, and no argument can legitimately be made that the public entity so thoroughly invades that contractor's operations as to be considered a co-employer of the employee. That's frankly how I read that language, and the RTD brief in general saying, we agree with the Court of Appeals here, but if you don't, Supreme Court, don't leave us saddled with Perkins that provides that we're an employer, but doesn't necessarily, if you overturn Hennessy, give us some of the immunities and protections that we believe are appropriate. But again, I didn't write the brief, and I don't speak for them here today. Once you get past the step of determining how you're going to decide a public employee and then applying that test here, you have two other issues only, and that is whether someone can legitimately be a co-employee of a public and private entity, and it's not reasonably disputed by Ms. Hennessy that you can. The law supports that determination. And I think in terms of whether or not this definition of public employee should in some fashion, as petitioner seems to advance, be read to exclude those co-employees or dual employees, that is something that the statute simply doesn't say and that the definition doesn't contemplate. And I think Mr. Cotton here has demonstrated ably for the court, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, and his public employee status. Both of them, both the trial court and the lower court, reviewed the contract, reviewed the statute, and applied the common law test that Norton suggests and requires, and reached that determination. And I would request that you do as well. And given Mr. Cotton's limitation on liability as opposed to his immunity, that you extend that limitation to his employer as well. Thank you.
Preparing for today and sitting here and listening, I realized that as I get older, I get dumber. I heard Justice Brenner's question, and in the years that I've been dealing with this case, I hadn't thought that through or noticed it. The definition of public employee states that a public employee has to be an employee of the public entity. And sure enough, there is a definition in the statute for public entity, which is specific and limited and certainly wouldn't include First Transit. And that's another reason that Mr. Cotton was not a public employee. Counsel says that Norton controls the outcome in this case. With all respect, counsel, Norton does not control this case. The provision of the independent contractor clause in the definitional sentence in statute 104, 103 sub 4, isn't even included in the citation in Norton. It's addressing a different issue, and when it cites to the statute, it leaves out that language. It does not discuss the concept of independent contractors and how they affect public employees. The issue in Norton involved supervisors at a county social services department seeking indemnification from the state of Colorado for their attorney's fees and costs when they were sued under a federal civil rights claim. And so there was no immunity as to those claims. And the statutes that is discussed is 2410.114. That is, when are they entitled to that kind of indemnification? And then the Norton Court does essentially, again, the common law analysis of whether they were employers or not. Interestingly enough, the Norton Court says that they weren't employees, and therefore the state wasn't responsible for those costs. If this opinion stands as it does now, counsel talked about how Perkins has been lurking in the background for the last 16 years and how that affects, for example, how contracts are formed. If this opinion stands as it does now, with all respect, every lawyer for every corporate entity doing business with any governmental entity is going to be putting the kind of language that's in the RTD contract in the contract with that public entity. Despite the fact that the public entity has other contract language, which is the case here, that says it's First Transit, not RTD that controls them, and despite the fact that the practical relationship, as reflected in Mr. Cotton's deposition testimony, is that RTD had no control over them. You will see this language in every contract, if this case holds up, and every private corporation doing business with a state entity is going to be coming to the court and saying,
thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank both counsel for their arguments. Case stands submitted. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning.